I'm afraid we're not altogether convinced of the official story in any way, shape or
form. I know you have, yeah.
This is Radio Caroline, broadcasting from the North Sea.
What's all this water coming in here?
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Knowle and leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the dramatic suicide of Bosnian Croat leader Slobodan Praljak on the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague just has his appeal against a 20-year sentence that would most likely have seen him die in prison. Also, the accession to the Zimbabwe throne of former intelligence chief, then Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, much to the jubilation by the BBC and the rest of the corporate media, and concerns today that he's appointed Zimbabwe army generals to several key cabinet jobs. Could the military have been plotting behind Mugabe's back? Perish the thought. And alongside news that tens of thousands of unofficial US troops remain on the ground in Syria comes the ominous news that China's readying ground troops to send to Syria too, to prevent any attempt by Britain's Ministry of Defence and the Pentagon to reignite attempts to remove Syria's President Assad after the demise of their al-Nusra and ISIS proxies. And last weekend's massive attack on a Sinai mosque left over 350 worshippers dead. Still, nobody's claimed the attack. How could the Egyptian military allow a squad of 20 to 30 gunmen to wander around in their country? So what was the purpose and who had the means and the motive? Down the road, Saudi's unofficial king, Mohammed bin Salman, continued to use British and American jets and bombs and RAF personnel even to massacre Yemeni civilians, but the EU is banning arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Revisiting Libya finally from the best social services, living conditions and infant mortality rate in Africa to regular massacres and now even slave markets in 5 short years. We revisit the bloody and illegal regime change invasion orchestrated mainly by the French and the British militaries. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 degrees Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, mainly cloudy with some light rain at times. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, sunny spells and some wet and windy weather later in the week. Next weekend, that's the 8th and 9th of December, highs of 7 Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, apologies to those who've been contacting me by different means to ask about the suspension of the politics show for the last 2 weeks. I've given the commitment to BCFM station manager that I won't be making any statement about why. So, thank you for your concern. I've not been ill, and we hope to be back to normal next Friday. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Councillor for Knowle, leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the politics show. Well, it's been a busy week, isn't it? I feel particularly irked to not be on the FM and on the air because of all the events this week. Just take us through some of it.
Well, I mean, is it the bigger shambles in Bristol administration or the national administration? It's difficult to tell, really, because you just couldn't make it up for either of them. I mean, it was actually coming in Bristol, Marvin's latest throwing out of the toys from the pram. He did that with us a few months ago, trying to say that everyone else was fine with him and we were acting irresponsibly by questioning him and challenging him. And now apparently everyone else is evil too. So there you go.
Okay, so first it was the Lib Dems, Claire Campion-Smith. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, it was the most bizarre and incompetent sacking I've ever seen, because the senior officers that she was working with weren't even told that it was happening. And Claire didn't have any communications at all.
Well, I mean, surely you'd complain if she hadn't been told first.
Well,
I mean, that's the first person you tell if they're going to get sacked is the person themselves. You don't want to go round behind their backs, do you?
Well, that's what happened. Basically, it was messy, and I believe it probably, this time at least, he wrote to the Conservative and Green groups and said, you've been naughty boys, you're on the naughty step, and basically, I'm getting rid of your two members from the Cabinet.
So what was the reason, let's just dwell on Claire Campion-Smith for a minute, what was the reason given for her
Well, he never actually did give one, but he sort of muttered something half-heartedly to her about couldn't work with the party. Although he never said anything that she'd done wrong, and I believe that's the case here as well, that there's not been no complaint about the Green or Conservative councillors who've left, what they've been up to. I mean, we don't really know too much, but he's complained that he can't work with the parties.
The thing is that there were similar sorts of things going on under George Ferguson, Gary, weren't there, where he fell out with one or two of his cabinet members over the years when he was mayor.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know... One petulant mayor followed by another, and I'm afraid that, you know, it shows you that the system itself is fatally flawed.
But just a minute, if you were mayor, maybe you'd be petulant too.
The position should not exist. The problem with it is, even if the Labour Party members now, as they have done on the libraries issue, a number of them voted with us on a motion the other day, it'll have no effect. He can just completely ignore them, and that's part of the problem. If you have a leader of the council as opposed to a directly elected mayor, if they're up to stupid things, they've got to answer to the other councillors there. He doesn't have to answer to anybody.
What about the... I mean, the situation right now is that what we've got is... we've got Marvin in charge, but, I mean, at the end of the day, he's got to assert his authority, hasn't he?
I mean, he's got to stamp his feet, you mean? I mean, really, it just looks utterly silly, doesn't it?
Well, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, I think, you know, this seems to me about a bunch of people who are not playing ball being told, well, you've got to, you're just not behaving yourselves, so we're going to have to bring this in-house, effectively make it an entirely Labour cabinet. And that is understandable. I mean, most cities around the country do it that way anyway, Gary, don't they?
Well, I mean, he made a pledge that he was going to have an all-party cabinet, and then he didn't actually have one because it wasn't really cabinet. Things weren't done on a collective decision-making basis. It was just they were there for semi-window dressing and doing bits and pieces. But there's no collective decision-making at all, which is what cabinet government is supposed to be about. So really, you know, it was a bit of a farce right from the beginning, and really it was just something that got him elected by promising to work with others, and he hasn't.
Okay, what about the two that have gone this week? What do you know about them? That's the Conservative Claire Hiscott and Green Party's Fee Hance.
I know very little about the work that they're supposed to be doing, because I haven't seen any evidence of it.
But what about why they've been sacked?
The statement from Marvin is he couldn't work with the parties. He couldn't work with us previously, and he can't work with the Conservatives or the Greens now. And that's what his statement says.
Take us through this library decision, because this sounds like it might have something to do with all of this, where he's actually got people within his own party who are disagreeing with him too over libraries.
Well, I mean, the decision on that he was going ahead on the libraries and the consultation was a farce, basically. There's a large amount of money was spent getting thousands of people to respond to a consultation. People were given the choice of three absolutely unacceptable choices. And the biggest response, actually, was none of the above, followed by lots of reasons why what they were putting down as preconditions were completely wrong. So they gradually begin to realise they have a bit of a problem. We put in, Lib Dems put in an alternative suggestion, which didn't cost any more money, and in actual fact delivered the savings, but actually kept most of the libraries open. And then that went through scrutiny, and the other parties agreed with us. And when we put down a motion at the last full council, two Labour members actually voted with us, as did the other two parties, and several abstained or went to the loo when the vote came on from the Labour Party.
Yeah, I suppose many people will be pointing at Marvin saying, you can't even keep your own party in order, Marvin.
Well, you know, it's not a happy ship. And this, you know, it's not just the councillors who are now upset. I mean, we've had a lot of senior managers leaving the authority at absolutely ridiculous.
But that was surely nothing to do with Marvin. That was Anna Klonowski, the chief exec. Well, surely.
Well, who employed Anna Klonowski. I can't tell you the details in every case. All I can say is a lot of senior managers were very unhappy and left. Now, ultimately, the mayor who employs the chief executive is responsible.
Now, there are various figures been going around about how much she was paid off for actually stepping out of a job. So there is an argument that says that she didn't need to be paid off at all. So,
well, of course,
what's
she didn't need to be
that?
Paid off. I mean, he's actually put out the statement that she resigned for family reasons. Well, you know, I'm not certain how many people actually believe that or not.
That's the standard response, isn't it, in central government as well? To spend more time with my family, I think, is the one.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. But, I mean, if that was the case, that she actually resigned, she's not entitled to any payment at all. If, on the other hand, as some people are suggesting, the place was in mayhem and he had to get rid of her very quickly, there is a provision for paying for some gardening leave and that sort of thing. But he can't have it both ways. He can't have the situation where he says it was a voluntary leaving and I'm entitled to pay her off.
So, but I don't imagine the City Council's legal services are going to be suing her for the money back, but, I mean, is the money going to come back for us to be spent on services here?
Well, we're encouraging people to sign a very good petition, which is at www.taxpayersmoney.weebly.com, which is demanding a thorough inquiry into this. I and some other people from other parties have written to the council's auditors asking for a whole list of questions to be answered, and we're intending in a not too distant future to have this debated at full council to really get to the bottom of it.
Okay, so we'll put a link up to that on our show page. Just, do you want to just repeat whereabouts this petition is?
Yeah, www.taxpayersmoney.weebly.com.
Okay, and we'll put up, well, I'll find an exact link and put it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But Martin Summers, this is not looking good, is it? We people elected Marvin on this all-party ticket. Now, we're not talking about the Lib Dems, the Tories, the Greens running the council, but just sitting in there with the cabinet. To a certain extent, you know, they're bound to be bystanders because he has all the power, but now they're not even that.
Well, I'm dismayed to hear that things are sounding as if they're so bad and that feelings are running so, so high about this. You've got to remember, I would argue that most people who voted for Marvin basically voted for the Labour Party. They didn't vote for Marvin, they voted Labour. And they didn't necessarily expect there to be an all-party council. So,
but he did say that, didn't he?
He may have done so.
Well, he
if he did say that,
I would
argue that most people would largely have ignored that. They voted. I mean, people don't vote for Marvin Rees; they vote for the Labour Party.
Ah, well, I would say one thing though: there was an awful lot of people who wanted to get rid of the previous mayor and voted for anybody that they thought could beat him.
Well, indeed, and of course, you know, and Marvin came in with a pretty convincing win, suggesting that the mood had shifted and so on.
But this is not a very good politics to be at, is it? Where we're thinking we want to vote for someone because they're the most likely to get rid of someone else.
Well,
we want to surely be voting for somebody that we do want. And many people who voted for Marvin would have been voting that way.
They would. And I actually agree with Gary that the mayoral system is a bad system. It's the wrong way to run things because it leads to this kind of train wreck situation where he hasn't actually got a mandate. At the same time, he's got all the power. And there's no way of changing that.
Now, there will be.
Well, yes, because we may move back to having, you know, reinvent the wheel,
yep,
and have things as they used to be with a party leader leading the council, as used to be the case. But of course, if we do revert to what might call normal politics, with the vote as it is in Bristol at the minute, you'd have a Labour administration led by Marvin or another, and other parties would be the opposition, which would be the case in most other cities in the country.
Well, you might do. I would suggest that things might be a little bit different after 2020. Who can tell? But even if it was a Labour leader with a Labour cabinet and councillors supporting them, they would have the power, when he does something utterly ridiculous and stupid, to call him in.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why I agree with you that we should have a party system rather than a personality system.
So is there any checks and balances within the Labour Party on what Marvin does? Can he just do what he wants?
In theory, there would be, ultimately, but at the same time, the power, if he was to say he was going to resign from the Labour Party and carry on running Bristol as Marvin, we wouldn't be able to stop him, because that's the setup. It's a Tory conception, this, of having a CEO to run a company rather than a political solution for what is a political institution.
Yeah, and he's exactly now become CEO, effectively, by saying that we're not going to have a chief executive. I mean, that didn't work 20 years ago. It led to disaster for Bristol for quite some while. But the whole structure now of the senior management of the council is in flux, and there's chaos.
Well, I mean, I think it's it'd be interesting to see how well he gets on, because really, I mean, surely the mayor should be much more of a chairman-type character than a CEO. I mean, he needs to appoint somebody.
Not under the legislation that we've got.
He surely needs to be, there needs to be somebody who's in there 24-7, who's seriously qualified, legally qualified, etc., in that job, and has got all the experience of running larger public administration.
Well, look, I mean, the CEO is a CEO, and the political leadership is the political leadership. They shouldn't be mixed up, basically, and that's what's happening. Yeah. Is that the whole thing is being treated as if it is a company, and it isn't a company, it's a local authority, which is what it should have, a political setup which allows party politics to operate. If alliances are to be formed, for example, between the Labour and the Greens, there'd have to be a discussion between the two parties, and so on, rather than, the CEO, who's winner-takes-all, just picks who he wants to work with and does what he likes, because he's got the power to run the whole city without referring to anybody until the next election, hasn't he?
Well, Marvin Rees has been accused of poor leadership following a decision to scrap his cross-party cabinet. This is on Bristol 24/7. Green councillor Fee Hance and Tory Claire Hiscott both effectively fired in the surprise shake-up just 8 months this week after the mayor's last reshuffle. This is, on Bristol 24/7. Opposition parties have reacted in fury, with the Greens' Eleanor Cumley arguing the future of Bristol is simply too important to be held hostage to one man's ego, whilst Bristol's Conservative leader Mark Weston accused the mayor of being increasingly political. Rees contends, which is actually surely exactly what he's there for, Mark. Rees contends the behaviour of other parties has made the cross-party cabinet arrangement untenable, and he maintains Labour Party priority remains the delivery of our city aspirations, not cheap headlines. Well, this does imply that what he's annoyed with, Gary, is that various comments from people within the cabinet from other parties have been hitting the headlines.
Well, not necessarily people within the cabinet, because basically he's never issued one word of complaint against any of the three women from the three different parties that he sacked. He was basically having a go at the parties. So presumably me, in the case of the Liberal Democrats, and, we haven't always got along particularly well, presumably Mark Weston of the Tories and the Green
Party.
Well,
what about this accusation by Fee Hance here that Marvin's got a very fragile ego?
Well, yes. It's a huge one and very thin. It breaks very easily. I mean, it's just very sad to watch that somebody who hasn't, if you're in a position of that sort, with the amount of power that he's actually got, you've got to be able to take criticism and people not agreeing with you.
That's one thing that George did, definitely. He was taking criticism all the time. I can remember at the Anarchist Book Fair, he even got a cup of hot coffee thrown over him, and he just sort of shrugged it off. I wonder what Marvin were doing that sort of situation. If you just do wonder about the, particularly now, taking this much more chief executive style role, about the qualifications. Is Marvin qualified for the job?
No.
Well, he's not supposed to be running the technical side of the council. He's supposed to be a political leader of the Labour Party in Bristol.
Well, he can bring advisers around, well, unofficial
exactly.
advisers
exactly.
around
well,
himself.
He's not listening to
advisers,
is he, apart from his press
Yeah, but officer. Winston Churchill couldn't read a balance sheet, but he ran the whole country. The idea that the political leadership have to be competent to do the stuff, it's not a company, and they're not a company director. They are the political leader of a political party, and he's not actually the leader of the Labour Party in Bristol, he's just the mayor. And our internal structures have been distorted by this mayoral setup.
Yeah, and I mean, having been in an administration, I can tell you, you do have to listen to legal advice given to you to make certain things. And you do then have to work with officers who are going to deliver the actual stuff. You talk through with them. This is what we'd like to do. Well, I think you can do that because of this. And you have to come to an arrangement with them that actually works.
Yeah, leadership doesn't replace the technical leadership, does it?
What Eleanor Cumley has been saying is that he's unable to accept any sort of criticism, constructive or otherwise. That's on the BBC this week.
Yeah, well, she's absolutely right, I'm afraid.
This is a worrying trait, she says, Martin. A thin skin is not a helpful attribute if you want to be responsible for running a city. Denial of views other than your own and an inability to listen reflects poor leadership.
Well, I learn more about this stuff by coming on these shows than I would find out otherwise. I recognise that he's in a very difficult position. Whoever it was would be in a very difficult position. And I don't intend to try and make
I mean, he's on
worse.
The right of your party, isn't
well,
he?
Well, no, he's in the centre.
Well, he's
I'd
trying
say,
to
currently.
Say he's in the centre. Well, what do you think, Gary?
Well, I can't work out where he is because there's nothing coherent coming out at all.
What I would say is this, is all of these people making these criticisms are significant because those people are entitled to their views and they've made them public. So we do know that some people are saying he's got a fragile ego. Now, the only answer to that from his point of view is to demonstrate that he hasn't, and maybe he can't.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to something else, a local story, and this is not from this week's Prime Minister's Questions, it's from last week's, because we didn't have a show last week, and this is Thangam Debonair, Bristol West Labour MP, asking a question at PMQs about a BBC Bristol film called Drugland.
Thangam Debonair.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the BBC are currently broadcasting Drugsland, a documentary series shot in my constituency of Bristol West, showing the catastrophic impact of drugs and drug laws, not just on users, but on the police and innocent bystanders. So will the Prime Minister commit to watching Drugsland and to a Royal Commission on our drug laws, which are plainly failing?
Yeah. I'm pleased to say that the Home Office, under my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, launched the government's drug strategy only a matter of weeks ago. We recognise the importance of this issue. Drugs significantly affect people's lives, and sadly, we also see people dying as a result of drugs, taking drugs, but also the criminal activity that takes place around drugs. We take this very seriously. That's why we've launched our strategy.
Now, that film, Drugsland, did seem to focus mainly on it. Have you seen it, Gary? Have you seen parts of it?
I haven't seen the programme, but I know what leads up to it. And basically, I'm very glad that now one or two people in the Labour Party is starting to catch up and realise that, you cannot enforce, just rely on enforcement entirely to actually deal with the drugs problem.
But the programme was looking mostly at street trading of drugs, street dealing of drugs, whereas, of course, most of the drug dealing goes on inside nightclubs and things like that, actually probably with the tacit blessing of the people who run those nightclubs. So that, and we've seen actually the two deaths I know about over the last few years, both took place from people who got their drugs inside nightclubs.
I'm sure that's where the majority of it actually happens. The point is, though, that it's how the law actually looks at drugs and whether it actually is wasting its time and being counterproductive by trying to chase people for possessing small amounts of drugs instead of actually realising that it's a major health problem for people. And, you can't actually enforce your way out of it.
Well, surely recreational drugs is not a health problem. It's just people are doing it to have a bit of fun.
Oh, it is potentially a health problem for huge numbers of people. And they actually, but it should not be treated as a pure criminal matter for most of the people.
Well, most parents would disagree with you, Gary, wouldn't they? They'd say, actually, I don't want my children taking drugs. Many would anyway.
Well, I wouldn't want my children taking drugs, and they don't. But the difference is that you steer them away from dangerous drugs by education and explaining to them and pointing out the dangers rather than, the police having to try and enforce, which is an impossible job for them to do. Having chaired Safe for Bristol for a number of years, I know the police's view on this. Secretly, they realise that, it's a job that they cannot possibly win on.
Well, I'd second that entirely. I'd go further. I mean, it's what they've done in Portugal. They did it about 20 years ago now. They decriminalised possession of small amounts of drugs, whatever they were. So the low-level people, if they get caught, they get cautioned or they get steered in the direction of social services or whatever. But they don't.
In Bristol, they get prosecuted, don't they? They had a whole load of homeless drug dealers were prosecuted and sent to jail recently. Well, it was last year, I believe.
Depends what you mean by dealers, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is, because there's dealers and there's dealers, isn't there? It works on every level. But the other thing, even more important, I think ultimately you've got to move to decriminalisation. Not just decriminalisation as in Portugal, but legalisation and regulation. Because then you squeeze the illegal part of the market out, which is, of course, a lot of the crime in places like Mexico is people being shot, tortured, killed because of the money involved, which can't be settled through the small claims courts. And that's fundamental. And, of course, ultimately underlying all of this, of course, is the fact that in the 1980s, for example, when we were supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to drive the Red Army out of Afghanistan, a lot of that was funded with a nod and a wink by heroin supplies into Britain. And MI6 were very well aware of what was going on, and they turned a blind eye because they had a bigger fish to fry. And, of course, ultimately, if we're going to actually prosecute criminals for dealing drugs, you start off with Colonel Oliver North from the United States, who was at the heart of the Iran-Contra affair, moving cocaine into the cities in the US to fund a slush fund to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. It all came out. He should have been prosecuted. He was given a pardon. And, of course, under existing US law, he should have been executed. In fact, he's a hero to the right wing in the US. And I'm not really interested in what they have to say about drug prohibition because it's nonsense.
Just cycling back to the story about the sacking of the councillors this week from Marvin Rees, Labour Mayor's cabinet. Two new cabinet members have been announced by Bristol City Council. Green Party's Fee Hansen, Tory Claire Hiscott were both told to go from their top jobs. And Anna Keane, councillor for Hillfields Ward, will take on the education portfolio. And on Kai Dudd, who represents Central Ward, will step up and take over from Ms Hance. Do you think there's a good choices, Gary?
I think they've got very little experience.
Also, another story in the Bristol Post today is Colston's Primary School is making a decision on removing a controversial slave trader's name. It's almost like they don't dare say it in the title, but of course they have to because it's Colston himself. Anyway, so that's the Colston's Primary School has voted to change its name, although its new identity has yet to be revealed. This sounds to me like a bit of a mess, really. Surely they should at least have a name to announce that this is going to be the new name before announcing they're going to get rid of the old name. Well, it's almost like they're in no man's land now.
The same thing happened with the Colston Hall. There'd been a commitment to actually change the name when a sponsor came in, and basically they need the money to do some of the improvement work there, and that seemed eminently sensible. But people who were campaigning, you know, to abolish the Colston name didn't actually listen to any of that. So we had a position where they'd already made the commitment to get rid of the name. And, you know, to get a sponsor's name instead. And all that happened was the campaign has reduced the amount of money they're going to get for changing the name.
Is this getting a bit silly, though, isn't it? We can't get rid of every single Colston, surely.
Well, the problem is that, you know, you can't... He did exist. The unpleasant things that we do not approve of did actually happen. And blanking somebody's name out does not make that go away. You need education. You need to have people aware of what happened and to fully realise what happened.
I suppose what they're doing is concentrating on the most obvious things, where we actually want to educate young people into understanding who Colston was, and calling your school after him, like almost like your headmaster or your headmistress is his emissary on earth, you know, is something a little bit peculiar. But so maybe they've done the right thing by getting rid of from the schools, maybe, Gary.
Well,
Martin.
Well, I mean, schools' names are being changed. I mean, Monk's Park no longer exists. All of the names are being changed constantly. I mean, you know, there's rebranding goes on all the time in the education sector now. So getting rid of Colston's name is actually a no-brainer. You just get rid of it and call it something else. Colston Hall, I'd change it. You don't have to have that. Things get changed. Names get changed. Things change all the time.
Anyway, let's go back to Westminster. And this week's Prime Minister's Questions, we had Emily Thornberry standing in for Jeremy Corbyn and Damian Green standing in for the Prime Minister, Theresa May, on the NHS.
Emily Thornberry!
I suspect that neither the nation nor his own constituents will have taken any reassurances from that answer. Mr. Speaker, we have an NHS which is in the grip of a chronic funding and staffing crisis. GPs are quitting in record numbers. Yeah. Junior doctors are running A&Es without supervision. Yeah. Our nurses are at breaking point. Yeah. And all this is before the winter crisis that is coming. Yeah. So, Mr. Speaker, Let me finally ask the First Secretary, what does it say about the government's priorities that last week's budget could only find £350 million to help the cash strap stretched to the limit NHS cope with the winter fuel crisis? £350 million to cope with the winter crisis.
That's right.
and was able to find 11 times that amount to spend on a no-deal Brexit.
Yeah.
Isn't that the very definition of a government fiddling away whilst the rest of the country burns?
Yeah.
The Right Honourable Lady is determined to talk the NHS down. It's a Conservative government which is increasing funding on the NHS so it remains the best health service in the world, as the Independent Commonwealth Fund has repeated for the second year in a row. It's this party which promised and delivered more money for the NHS in 2010, 2015 and in last week's budget, where my Right Honourable Friend the Chancellor promised £6.3 billion extra for the NHS. More patients treated, more operations carried out by more doctors and more nurses. And when she says at the end that the government is wasting £3 billion on preparing for Brexit, we now know that the Labour Party doesn't think it's worth preparing for Brexit. They do though think it's worth preparing for a run on the pound. That's all you need to know about Labour.
He sort of went off the subject there, Damien Green, a little bit. And well, first of all, how do you think he did, Gary?
And
Emily.
Well, the Labour front bench is pretty desperate. She's probably about the best of a bad bunch. And Damien Green is not exactly flavour of the month at the moment, is he?
He was supposed to have found pornography on his computer, supposedly, according to the police. But, I mean, that's not illegal for him to have pornography on there. And also, everybody knows that sometimes things like that can come through on your email, for example.
Yes, well, I think the detailed statement from the police officer today, who is the computer expert, sort of made very clear there wasn't a 30-second mistake there. It was a large amount. Now, what he said was he couldn't prove it was Damien Green looking at it, but the pattern of use suggested that it was. Now, the only reason he spoke out was because when his ex-boss, who'd been in charge of that operation, said about the pornography and what had actually happened, that there was a smear campaign organised against him. Now, I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but basically that's why the police officer spoke out today.
I mean, surely this isn't, again, a smear operation against Damien Green?
Well, possibly. I don't know.
I mean, is politics really all that? Is that all it's about, one smear after another?
Well, you know, Bristol Labour seem to be involved in a bit of that, don't they, sir?
Anyway, Martin, what do you make of what's... Are the NHS going to survive this winter?
Well, obviously, I'm not an expert, but people who are, including the chiefs of the NHS, are pretty unhappy. The general policy has been... I mean, they mentioned the Independent Commonwealth Fund there, and saying that the British National Health Service is the best in the world. It's the best value for money in the world. But it's not the best in the world because we don't spend enough on it. The outcomes in places like France and Germany are better because they spend more. But the national health system, because it's based upon central planning, basically, rather than on market forces, even though the Tories have tried to push it in that direction over the years they've been in charge of it, is a more efficient way of doing it.
The trouble with market forces is if you can convince someone to take some treatment that they don't necessarily need...
Indeed.
And charge 10 times more than it costs for it, then suddenly that comes across as a positive.
Well, you saw that in Damien Green, said we've treated more people and so on. When you don't actually want to treat more people, it's become an illness service and so on.
I'm afraid it's been that way for a very long
time.
Well,
I know, but I mean, in principle, a national health service can plan to make people healthier.
It should be preventative. And
preventative rather than just wrapping up afterwards.
Unfortunately, the way it was set up right at the beginning didn't really assist with that.
No, well, because you've obviously got vested interests like pharmaceutical companies, consultants and so on, who want more product because that's what they're about.
It does seem to me, though, it's being kind of slowly starved and run down, a bit like the railways were before they were privatised.
I think that's right. I mean, obviously, there is an aspiration on the right wing of politics in Britain to get rid of it. There always has been.
I always remember the Duke of Edinburgh saying, oh, well, the NHS is a sacred cow. Mm. We're not allowed to say anything about it. Mm. And with a very strong implication that he'd love to get rid of it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's much appetite in the country to move away from the basic model we've got, although it could improve quite dramatically. It's got to be based on, you know, need and free at the point of use. But actually, it's still inefficient in lots of those ways. There isn't the local scrutiny that there ought to be.
Well, one of the things we keep hearing is that there are a lot of patients that have been retained in hospital unnecessarily because there is nowhere for them to go into a care home or a home care package for them. And this week there was a report all about this. The Competition and Markets Authority has revealed it's taking enforcement action against a number of care homes that have been unfairly demanding large upfront fees or charging families for weeks after the death of an elderly relative. The UK care homes are grappling with an unsustainable £1 billion a year funding gap caused by councils not paying enough money, which results in many homes charging residents over the odds in order to stay afloat, an official review has found. And this is by the Competition and Markets Authority, Gary. I mean, we're being told generally that it may be that by 2020 that elderly care is the only thing that local governments will be paying for. I mean, I don't know if it includes things like cleaning the streets and that sort of thing, but I mean, if they can't even pay for what they're supposed to be paying for it now, what hope is there for the elderly who need this care?
Well, I mean, it's a very, very severe problem, and it's at least part of it is the lack of coordination, the split between sickness, the National Health Service, as it were, and the local authority responsibilities. Unless those are tied together significantly better, we'll have a permanent problem.
I was listening to or watching the, we call it Borrow Time, Question Time, which is mostly goes on about Brexit, the same things, almost the same questions revisited every week. But actually they had Yanis Varoufakis on last night, and he was suggesting this whole thing of people's QE, Martin. He only just about got a chance. Dimbleby, Bullingdon Club boy, tried to talk over him, but he managed to get it out just about that actually what they need is we need a new central government managed development bank and people's QE, that is to say creating money to spend directly onto services like this.
I didn't hear it, but no doubt more radical policies than have been considered for a generation are going to have to be considered.
I mean, we can't just keep going on and on and on saying there's not enough money for all the basic things we need. The most important things in society, like education, 1,000 less teachers here in Bristol, the hospitals, schools and social care.
Well, I think the whole narrative around austerity is broken down, particularly with giving £1 billion to the DUP to keep them sweet in Northern Ireland, and the fact that they've not been able to bring the deficit down within one term of Parliament, two terms. Now it looks like it's pushing to the indefinite future. If we're going to carry on having zero interest rates, and that is a big if, then it doesn't actually cost that much to borrow to invest. But of course the real problem is, and it's been the real problem all along, is the banks are still bust. They're as bust as they were in 2008, as we're going to find out,
well,
whoever the government is.
My favourite story of the week, I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, it's my privilege I suppose, and this is the Daily Mirror's version, rail boost for Britain by reopening lines axed in the 1960s. Disused railway lines could get a new lease of life under government transport plans. Mind you, we hear all about HS2 and Hinkley and that never happens, so maybe this will never happen either. Transport ministers will accelerate plans to restore a rail link between Oxford and Cambridge, and lines axed in the 1960s could be reopened in a major boost for the railway network. Rail services lost under Beeching and the British rail cuts of the 60s and 70s could be restored to kickstart crucial housing developments or help create new economic opportunities. The Transport Secretary Chris Grayling wants to identify new transport projects that will unlock economic growth and housing development across the country and ease crowded commuter routes. But then there are We haven't actually managed to make many steps forward here within Bristol with this rail network.
I mean, one of the most obvious cases is the Portis headline, and that falls down on practicalities. Half these lines that...
Well, hang on. Why is it falling down? I mean, it's an obvious thing to... You've got loads of people in Portishead that would be using that.
Exactly. The problem actually is that the track going through the gorge is not up to the standard required to run trains.
Oh, hang on.
At a certain speed.
Right. Okay.
They could run through the gorge a little slower, but there's been a political commitment made to having a certain frequency of train.
These trains aren't going to fall off the track into the gorge. I don't believe it.
Well, there is a safety limit, and one of the reasons why people like railways is they are safe in the UK, you know, under whichever ownership it's actually been. Train crashes are very rare, and quite frankly, I'd rather keep it that way. And you can, in actual fact, solve that problem, the Portis headline, by saying that through those certain sections, the train has to go a bit slower, so it takes 3 minutes more to get from Portishead to Bristol. You know, that isn't a major problem. But because a political commitment's been made, and because of trying to tie up with other timetables, it's created a problem. They've decided they need to spend a fortune on doing up the quality of the line.
Is it one of those things that's also to do with cross kind of local authority problems or not?
I don't think that's a major part of it in this particular case. Sometimes there are that problem, but there is a practical problem. But unfortunately, people aren't prepared to adjust what the political commitment is to make something actually work. And I mean, frankly, the Portishead line could be operating, but it's very difficult at a sensible price to get it operated on exactly a half-hour schedule.
At the moment, there, of course, there's a lot of freight going backwards and forwards along there. That is to say cars, isn't it? Mostly cars, I would imagine, backwards and forwards to Portbury. Not much further to get to Portishead. Come on, folks, get your finger out. Maybe the Transport Secretary, Chris Grayling, will reopen this line eventually.
Well, maybe he will. I doubt it, though. I mean, he's absolutely famous for making all sorts of pronouncements and then nothing happening. And let's not forget, a lot of these lines that were closed under beaching have been built over or turned into other things, so a lot of them are just unavailable.
Well, you can have a tunnel underneath the house or whatever it is that's built there anyway. What about the Henbury Loop? What's happening with that?
Well, not very much at the moment. It makes absolute sense to reopen that. It would be a significant improvement, particularly with all the houses that are going into North Bristol. And particularly, of course, if we get our arena stuck out there, which might happen.
That's the only way of actually getting the arena built is to say, oh, we'll build a train line to it. Martin, why is it that the roads lobby seems to be so able to stop any kind of real reopening of railway lines, or else opening almost existing railway lines to passenger traffic when there's clearly the demand there? It just seems bonkers that everyone's being forced into their cars.
Well, it's partly path dependency. Once you've made silly decisions like having a QWERTY keyboard or whatever, you're stuck with it. And once you've closed these lines down, you can't really just rewind the video and say, why don't we do it like we used to do it? People, there were less cars around when beaching was operating.
Well, there's more reason to reopen these tracks. Well, I've had a chat with a former oil executive who's absolutely convinced that there was only one reason why beaching was brought in. By the way, he was the metallurgist on the British Atomic Bomb Project, something called Tube Alloys, after the war, that built the British atom bomb for Churchill and was revealed in the 1950s. But the reason he says it happened was because they discovered North Sea oil in the 1950s, but the Americans wouldn't finance the rigs and everything until the British opened up a domestic market in oil. And so something had to be done to get people off the trains and into cars, onto motorways, in order to start to open up the British domestic oil and petrol, diesel, whatever market. And then the Americans handed over the money, and then they started drilling all the rigs. He was involved in the industry at the time. So, I mean, you know, well, you're looking a bit sceptical there, Gary. But there must have been a reason for it. There must have been a reason for closing all these lines down, because what happened was the British Transport Commission, who were running the railways in the 50s, had completely prohibited any upping of the fares. So that was why they went bankrupt, because they weren't allowed to put a penny on a train ticket.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly why we're now getting less social housing built, isn't it, because of legislation to squeeze the rents down. So housing associations and councils who were reliant on a business case for a small amount of extra money coming in are now having to stop building houses.
Well, Okay. Also, another piece of news, this is in the Mail. More than 80% of students won't repay their loan in full. Taxpayers face a massive bill to cover graduate debt. Now, Gary, why are we using these loans? Because it just seems to me that effectively 80% of these are the government may have well been paying for them anyway to go to university.
Well, I mean, let's face it. I mean, you can't expect to get all of them back. Effectively, this system is a graduate tax with limited payment period backs, which is basically the right way that it actually should be. And I don't care if some people who leave university are on low income, don't pay it back. That's fine as far as I'm concerned. But I am concerned to make certain that, you know, mummy and daddy who have got huge amounts of money don't get overly subsidised.
Well, that's the old system, isn't it? The old grant system. The grants were means tested.
Well, I don't see a problem with the grant system. I think that it should be reinvigorated. But that doesn't mean to say getting rid of the loan system.
Well, I'm pointing the finger at you as the member of the party who was famously amongst all students talk about this, is that Nick Clegg, when he was in coalition, backtracked on this. They said they were never going to do it, and you did it. And just hang on, because now what we're seeing is that actually the taxpayers paying for it anyway, pretty much for 80% of students.
No, that's not the case. In actual fact, the loan, student loans, got introduced by the Labour Party when they were in power, and they promised not to bring them in, and immediately did. We did not have control of the system. We were in coalition over for a number of other reasons, and basically what we actually did do was to actually stop the position becoming significantly worse. And why we got lots of grief about it was because we agonised and tried to make the situation less worse than the Tories and the Labour Party actually wanted, and we got blamed for that.
Martin, over 60% of British students think their degree was a waste of time. This is a building contractor. I read this one in the I newspaper.
A building contractor?
A building contractor did the survey of 2,000 UK students.
He's after
apprentices. Well, that's not really...
60% of them.
Well, that's not really a proper...
Well, a building contractor paid for the survey. The survey is a proper survey.
It was a proper survey.
I'll put a link up to it on our show page. I think just have to take it as read that most UK students think their degree was a waste of time afterwards. Actually, there's a figure, I think it's 75% of graduates haven't found a professional job 6 months or a year after they graduate.
Well, that's to do with failures in the macroeconomy, which we could go over. But I think, in any case, educating people to the highest level that they can be educated for is not necessarily just for them to get a job with a load of money. We've got a better educated society than we've ever had. And I welcome
many of these courses are vocational, and yet there's no vocation at the end of
them. That's a problem with economic management, isn't it? It doesn't happen in Germany, but then they haven't been run by Tory fools for many generations like we have.
Back to here in Bristol, and a Labour Party member's whip slur at the Black Mayor. This is back to talking about Marvin Rees again. A Labour activist here in Bristol has unintentionally used racist words, and she's been forced to apologise for using words with unintentional racist connotations. Mal Sainsbury's called for a metaphorical horsewhip to lick our mayor into shape. Is this racist language, Gary?
I didn't see the context of it. It's a dangerous area to comment on when you don't know all the details.
She posted a message on Facebook, which apparently has caused outrage from equalities activists. Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees has questioned the appropriateness of the comment, Martin.
Well,
I'll just tell you what she says before you comment. Mrs. Sainsbury claimed she was referring to an incident in 1909 when a suffragette whipped Winston Churchill at the city's Temple Meads railway station.
Well, no doubt she will try and explain it in those terms, and others may take offence. I don't know enough about it.
Have we got a load of closet
comment.
Racists in the left of the Labour Party?
I think what happens is everybody's got to be very careful about the language they use, but you've also got to recognise people's intention isn't necessarily the way it comes out, and everybody's got their slant and take on these things. It's becoming a bit of a minefield for everybody, isn't it?
Then if we lose Bristol's libraries now, we'll never get them back. That's a comment from Bristol 24/7, Gary. We'll go back to the libraries again. Do you know which libraries are going to be saved and which libraries are not going to be saved, and what stage is all at now?
Well, we don't know because there's a cabinet decision which has been postponed. What our analysis research actually showed is that the vast majority of the libraries could be saved, and there was all sorts of ways that they could be helped, and a not-for-profit trust was the most effective way to actually protect the libraries, rather than a city council, which was made rather us. We didn't approve of the situation which the mayor wanted to bring forward, where you closed 17 of the libraries and kept just a core of 10, and really that was a very negative way. And a lot of the people who would be losing libraries are those who desperately needed them most in some of the most deprived areas.
Martin, aren't we being Luddites trying to keep these libraries open? Everyone uses the internet now. E-books, that sort of thing.
Well, no, I'm a very strong library user. I use the library every week, virtually. So for me, I would be very unhappy to see libraries close. I think the real problem is the austerity policy which we've been pursuing since 2008. And local authorities shouldn't be closing down these services. We should be investing in the future, including libraries, local railway. There's all sorts of things we could do. We need a list of things that need to be done, and we need to then do them and find the money afterwards.
Part of the problem here with the libraries is that Marvin is into this mode of everything's the evil Tories. Now, I don't approve of what the Tory government are actually doing, but bluntly, you've got to do the best that you can with what resources you've actually
got. About this people, what about this people's QE? Have you had a look at that? Because they were saying, effectively, quantitative easing, this money that the Bank of England is producing out of nowhere, is being spent to prop up share prices and property prices. It's not finding its way into the economy. And what John McDonnell was suggesting is we should be spending this money directly into government services.
I'm afraid that John McDonnell has made all sorts of silly pronouncements which I don't agree with. I haven't looked at the detail of personal QE.
The people's QE, it's called.
Well, the stuff I've read has suggested that you would only move to that if there's another crash. And of course, because there is going to be another crash, we probably will end up with people's QE. What's happening at the moment, we're in a kind of phony war situation where we've given up on austerity. That's pretty much clear. You know, the civil service know that that's not what we're doing anymore. And it doesn't matter who the government is. But they haven't actually thought through what we are going to do other than just bungle our way forwards. Now, the Labour Party at the moment are stuck in a bit of a position where they're trying to say, if things carry on as they are, then we would like to borrow more money to invest, which is a kind of sensible middle of the road thing to do, because that's what people are beginning to come round to. The problem is that the banking system, not just the British banking system, is still shot to pieces, and at some point it's going to crash.
Well, is this
and nobody is talking about what we're going to do. I mean, Varoufakis is aware of this, and that's why people say, well, we couldn't just spend money like that. If there is a crash, there's going to be things like exchange controls in Britain. If there's a crash after Brexit, there's going to be things like exchange control.
Well, certainly the way things are heading at the moment, it doesn't look very good
It's actually looking quite good, isn't it, this week, Gary? They've said £50 billion or £40 billion is going to be spent as the divorce bill, and suddenly the pound has leapt in the international trading. It's looking great, the pound, now.
Well, it's moved up slightly and recovered some of the massive losses it actually had, because they feel there might be some kind of trade deal. But I mean, bluntly, you mentioned £350 million for the NHS earlier on. You know, that was supposed to be coming every week.
Every week, yes.
Yeah. I mean, dishonesty that's involved.
Yeah,
is
there's probably going to be a run on the pound as we get closer to the cliff edge. And when there's a run on the pound, whoever the Chancellor is, if it's Philip Hammond still, he'll have to raise interest rates. And at that point, the property market will collapse. And that we're going to get a specific crash in Britain related to Brexit, which isn't related to the bigger crash related to the financial services sector in the US, Japan, etc. But of course, all of these things are linked.
Austerity you're talking about there, it's been linked a couple of weeks ago to 120,000 needless deaths as the policies is branded economic murder. The joint study from researchers at three top universities said the NHS and social care cuts could cause 100 unnecessary deaths a day without emergency funds. So it's not really good enough to wait until the crash. The interesting thing was that the BBC refused to run this story. And with a bit of digging around, I found that the website Tom Pride had a look at who it was that denied the story. The BBC used an independent organisation, big inverted commas, funded by the Daily Mail and the British government as fact-checkers to deny this 120,000 deaths story. But I'll put a link up to that on our show page. It's absolutely kosher. It's appalling that the national broadcasters are not covering it, because, of course, it's very bad. It looks very bad for the government. 100 unnecessary deaths a day being caused by austerity, Gary.
Well, they're saying in the future... I think that we need to look at what's actually happened. I mean, the squeeze down started, as Martin said, in 2008. For a few years, there was a tightening of the belts. Now, that's one thing. And actually, there was a redistribution under the previous government where there was extra taxes on the very rich, and there was some easing of tax on the bottom 20%. Now, it wasn't perfect. But since 2015, things have got extremely punitive and getting very, very dangerous indeed. And I'm very concerned that, yes, there will be very nasty consequences.
Well, I'll put a link to both of those articles up on our show page. One is the one about this so-called independent organisation, which the BBC looked at and decided not to run the story about the austerity being linked to 120,000 needless deaths. Also, we've had various changes in the Westminster Cabinet, haven't we, over the last month or so. The first was the Defence Secretary, who's been replaced by, can either of you remember who the new Defence Secretary is?
The ex-Chief Whip, but I can't remember what his name is.
Can you remember his name?
Gavin something.
Very good.
Williams.
Gavin Williams. Well, very good, Martin. Because the thing is, he's come out of nowhere, basically, straight off the street into the becoming Defence Secretary, which worries me. It makes me think, well, he's someone who the establishment has decided if we tell him to start a war, he'll start a war. He's got no real track record in any kind of ministerial post, but he's suddenly Defence Secretary, folks. And it was interesting to see that Veterans for Peace spokesperson Joe Glenton had some advice for the new Defence Secretary, Gavin Williamson.
Since the downfall of Michael Fallon, the British military has a new boss, Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson. Here's three bits of advice for you, Gav. The British press are going to tell you that Gavin Williamson's job is to go to government and lobby for more money for defence. But the problem isn't a lack of money in defence. The problem is massive, expensive vanity projects. Britain is spending £6.5 billion on two aircraft carriers it doesn't need, spending £2.5 billion on dodgy F-35 jets from America. It could be spending as much as £205 billion on Trident missile replacements, as well as spending huge amounts of money on a base in Bahrain. These massively expensive projects are about pursuing a defunct policy, which is at once about nostalgia for empire and keeping up with the Americans. What do these projects have in common? They're not about defence. They're about the offensive capability to fight wars in far-off places. Gav, you're joining a cabinet which says it's committed to taking back control for Britain. But you need to tell your Brexit mates when you get there that we really need to talk about the special relationship with the US. For example, how many EU bases are there in the UK? None. How many American military bases are there in the UK? Six. We are a military colony. Who controls the UK's nuclear arsenal? Is it the EU? No, it's the Americans. If they stopped supporting it, it would fall apart within months. How many wars has the EU dragged us into in the last 15 years? Zero. The US has dragged us into war after war after war. We need to de-link our foreign policy from America's. Last one, Gav, and don't melt. You need to unionise the military. I'm not talking about a licence to mutiny. What I am saying is that Britain's soldiers, sailors and airmen have earned the right to form a union as a basic self-defence mechanism against uncaring generals and indifferent politicians.
Well, I agree with all of that, I have to say. Particularly poignant was what he's mentioning, we're building a base in Bahrain. We withdrew from east of Suez in 1967 when we ran with our tails between our legs from Aden. And then we agreed that we weren't going to go back there at all. Now, of course, we're building a new naval base in Bahrain, which is going to cost a fortune, as he said. And of course, the people in Bahrain don't want us to be there. They're in open revolt against their British-backed government. The Khalifa family were imposed by the British when they gave the country independence in 1970s. And of course, it's not actually turned into a military struggle in Bahrain yet, unlike in Syria or Yemen, but it could. And that means that British sailors at that base, as allies of the Khalifa government, would be legitimate targets for Bahraini patriots. I'm not a pacifist. If you want to send a military base to our country where we don't want you, maybe we're going to fight you to get you out.
Some people would say the same about American bases here in Britain.
Well, they might. And the whole question of who gets put bases where and on what basis is a very interesting question, isn't it? The Americans have over 100 military bases all over the world. They go for what they call full spectrum dominance, including control of outer space. That's rather threatening to a lot of people and could cause World War III.
Okay, Gary, finally, what do you make of this? Because we're being told now, and we're going to talk about this after the news, but that the EU is now considering banning all weapon sales to the Saudis. I mean, this is rather puts mockers on our Middle Eastern foreign policy.
Well, I think it seems like a very sensible move, to be quite frank. And I think it says everything about the present government, that they want to play footsie with Donald Trump rather than working with our partners in Europe.
Okay. Are we ready to go to get some news? Yes, we are. And we can take some news from Tehran, it is today, not from the Murdoch news. Thanks very much, Gary. Cheers. See you after the news.